Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
And this is John Paul.
And this is your X Tuesday episode covering House of X number 3. And as a bonus, we're going to have House of X 4 out for you today also. It's really hard to separate the two. And we talked last time about how they did Powers of X 2 or Powers of 10 2 immediately followed by Powers of 10 3. In the reading order, and they were pretty connected. But you can see why they did, like, if they did that just to move Powers of 10 3 so that it didn't come in between House of X 3 and House of X 4, you can totally understand why they would do that, because these two, you got to read them just back to back. And I would even argue the next one, I mean, this ends on not necessarily a cliffhanger, but it ends in such a way, House of X4 does, that you're like, wait, I really gotta read the next one, which I can do. I haven't yet, but John Paul certainly couldn't. So I'm really glad that we have you here to give your thoughts on, like, the immediate impact of what goes down in issue 4, because holy crap, I mean,
yeah,
it feels like game changer. So and again, it's my own fault. I didn't read these as they were coming out and things were spoiled. So even as I was reading it, it was still brutal, but I was like, well, I know that it's not really the same kind of impact, but we'll get there. Let's talk about issue 3 first. So it starts off, well, first of all, great cover. We see Archangel, I guess it's Jean Grey, Monet, Nightcrawler. Is that Mystique
in the back?
No,
like below
night. I guess it's not. Yeah, because I'm thinking of this is the team that went to stop the Mother Mold from coming online, right? I mean, we see the big Mother Mold head. So we start at the front. We have Cyclops, we have Wolverine, we have Jean Grey, we have Nightcrawler, we have Monet. But who's that between Archangel and Monet?
It's Husk.
Oh, Husk. That's right. Husk.
Yeah.
Gotcha. All right, so that's the team that has been tasked by Professor X to go and stop this orbital platform that's a mother mold, which is a new concept we've never heard before, but basically, you know, a mother mold that can create more master molds, which then can create these, Omega level sentinels. So bad news, as we've talked about before. We get to the first page, "You make me so proud," quote from Professor X, obviously talking about his X-Men and what they need to do. And what they have done in the past to keep mutants kind of safe from harm. Interesting, we don't get any of the story this time before we get the title page. So I guess it all comes down to pacing. You know, I always think of the few pages we get before we get the credits page, like in a TV show, the first minute or two that you get, and then it plays the credits. But that's not always the case. Sometimes you want to change it around. You want to change the pace a little bit, or you don't want to stop the pace once you've gotten into the story. So written by Jonathan Hickman, Pepe Larraz handles the art, Marte Garcia on colors, and Clayton Cowell on letters, designed by Tom Mueller. It starts off, we're on Krakoa. Cyclops is saying it's done. He's put the team together. They're all good mutants, and they've accepted the mission for what it is, which I think a lot of them realize. They talked about it when Professor X first brought this to Cyclops and said, hey, you know, you're going on this mission to destroy this orbiting, satellite, this orbiting space station, and you're going to be really close to the sun, which powers it. So it's not only the added danger of being in space, and most mutants can't survive in space, they're just like humans in that way, but you're also millions of miles away from home, so it's not exactly a safe mission. I mean, this is a kind of a one-way trip, and I think a lot of them realize that because they cannot fail. They cannot afford to fail. This mother mold cannot be allowed to come online. So Cyclops goes on to say they understand the stakes and the risks. They understand and embrace it. So it's exactly.
You forgot one risk.
What's that?
You forgot one risk, one great risk. They're by an enormous ball of fire that burns so intensely. True.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like when I say it's close to the sun, it's like, yeah, really close to the sun. And that's how the supposedly the whole station is going to be powered by solar power. It's great. They understand the stakes, that being, hey, we've got to do this or mutants die, you know? And think about all the sacrifices everybody has made, including Moira, that we saw when we talked about Powers of 10, the last couple issues, basically giving up a whole one of her lives, spending part of that life, a significant portion of that life, in suspended animation so they could find out what, you know, when the true origin of Nimrod, when his true roots are, so they could stop it. I mean, the stakes have never been higher. And when we get to issue 4 of House of X, when we start talking about the different genocides and looking at the actual numbers, becomes more clear what the stakes really are. And then the risks, like we mentioned, John Paul, you know, bringing it to the forefront of the fact that you're right there by the sun, giant ball of fire, super dangerous. You're far, far away from home and you're in space, like, and there's no retreat. So definitely, I mean, if I was one of these mutants, I would be thinking, yeah, this is a one-way ticket. I wouldn't expect to survive. The good part is, though, you lay it all on the line because of the inherent risk. You don't expect to make it back, and because of the stakes, you know, so in your mind, you make peace with that. And I think that allows you to go above and beyond anything you would do normally. Like, there's no live to fight another day in my mind if I'm one of these mutants. So Professor X says, such a brave face you're wearing for me, but I hear the fear in your mind. And he's like, it's not, you know, is it wrong to be afraid and to have doubts? And Professor X says, no, of course not. What matters is you overcome it. So little Green Lantern reference there, right? It's not the fact you have no fear. Being heroic is the ability to overcome it. Which I think is 100%. I mean, these guys wouldn't be, I guess we can't say human, but that's the sentiment, right? Like, everybody experiences those emotions. You're right to be afraid. And one thing that's not mentioned here, yeah, he has fear and he has doubt. He doesn't go into it. Professor X doesn't talk about it. Cyclops doesn't talk about it. A lot of those fears could be he's fearing not death or being stranded out there, but he could have fear and doubts about what if we can't do it? What if we don't succeed and what that means? Like, his fear is for everybody else. He fears letting people down. He has doubts about whether he can pull this off. And if he doesn't pull it off, it means, hey, the end of mutants. So then we do get that quote from Professor X that we saw inside the front cover. You make me so proud. And he says, let me put your fears to rest. You're not going to die. I won't allow it. But again, that might not be what his only fear is. Although you assume that Professor X was reading his mind. But again, I think that it can be more complex than that. Magneto says the righteous never truly die. They live on, transformed into immortals by their mighty works. You know, that's the whole idea of living on in infamy or living on with a memorial and being remembered for this great thing you did. And I will also point out that Magneto has a fingerprint on his helmet. We've seen from Pepe Larraz in the past. We've talked about that a few times. I'm not sure why he does this shading that way, but I do. It doesn't pull me out of the story when I see it, but when I go and do like my art pass through, I always notice him now.
Yeah, I notice him too. Yeah. I didn't notice that one.
Yeah, it's right there. Just a little bit. Maybe it was a little bit too much of a bright spot. He just dabbed it with his finger.
Well, I noticed like a difference between my collected edition and then when I look at the digital or my single issues. So I think certain ones were altered a little bit, but.
Yeah, could be. But anyway, Magneto's whole idea is, you know, in order for you to die, you would have to truly die. You have to be forgotten. And nobody's going to forget the founder of the nations or people that made a big sacrifice so that the nation could exist. So Cyclops goes and gathers his team, says it's time to go. We get a little exposition here. So he's sort of reminding his team and really reminding the readers of what's going on. There's a rogue group of human scientists called Orcus. They're building the ultimate master mold, which is a mother mold. It's an orbit around the sun. They have to destroy it before it comes online because this is the genesis of where Nimrod comes from. So he says, okay, it's a nightmare machine. It produces mutant death, you know, basically produces sentinels that continue to evolve, you know, artificial intelligence and stuff. And the real danger there is that they think that this is the beginning of a technological paradigm shift to Nimrod, which is kind of the ultimate sentinel, the ultimate mutant killer. So as we said, that's the real danger. The fact that this is the origin of Nimrod. It's the first step toward him existing. So the other thing Cyclops tells them is they're not going to be taking any of the Krakoan fauna with them. So they can't take like a Krakoan seed or something like that. So they have a gateway to immediately teleport home. They're going to have to go get home the old fashioned way. You know, they're flying there in a ship and they're going to have to turn around and come back the same way. And Archangel's like, well, I don't get it. Why not? Why would we not want to be able to, you know, come back home easily? Like, you know, great emergency exit plan, as it were. And Monet's like, well, because you're only thinking of the success, like you're assuming that we're going to be able to do this, but what if we don't? And what if Mother Mold gets a chance to look at whatever Krakoan plants that we take with us and she figures out how it all works? And then she discovers something that we haven't. And all of a sudden the people we leave behind are threatened as well. And so Cyclops says, yeah, that's exactly it. We can't risk it. So no plants, everybody. Are you listening, Mystique? Because, you know, Mystique has a history of not following orders and, you know, double dealing, whole spy thing, betrayal, kind of suits her power set when you think about it, always disguising herself and whatnot. So Jean wants to know about the human crew. And Scott's like, well, the mission's to stop the Mother Mold no matter what, because that's the origin of Nimrod. And we want to keep the casualties as close to zero as possible. But, you know, we got to do what we got to do. You know, there's probably a lot of innocent civilians there, whatever security they have. But, you know, we have to do what we have to do. And Wolverine puts it a little more probably true to life, where he says innocent civilians don't build machines to exterminate a species. I'm kind of more on the lines of Wolverine. And I'm almost surprised that Jean, she usually is pretty pragmatic. She's usually pretty practical. Why she would even ask this, I wonder, because I'm totally on Wolverine's side. Like, if you're a human and you're out there and you're on this ship, this space station that's basically just exists to exterminate mutants, in my mind, you're not innocent. Like, you made that choice to go out there and you take the good with the bad, you know? So, and you got to realize how inherently risky it is just to be, you know, that far away just as a human. I mean, we talk about the risks that the mutants are taking to fly out there. I mean, the humans are taking the same risk, maybe not quite to the level because they're not out there actively trying to destroy it. But she's not willing to let it go. She's like, they're not soldiers. They're just scientists scared of their own future. I honestly don't really care what the reason is. If they're out there, I kind of disagree with that. I think, you know, if you've chosen to go out there and you're part of something that's trying to exterminate a whole species, like, I don't care what your reasons are. You're scared of the future, whatever. You're not a soldier, whatever. You're contributing to it. So I don't know. I feel like if you've chosen to go out there, you've chosen to be part of Orcus or work for them, you've kind of picked a side. So I don't really see you as innocent. I don't know. What do you think, John Paul?
Well, no one travels out that far from Earth not knowing what the reason is. And it's like, if you're a part of Orcus, you get the goal.
Yep, I agree. So, yeah, I wouldn't be out there looking to try to save any civilians. I mean, don't get me wrong. Take out the Mother Mold is the goal. You're not out there trying to exterminate people. But I also wouldn't be worried about any casualties, at least if I was in that position. So anyway, they do leave, but not from Earth. I mean, supposedly we saw them all get on to the ship in Krakoa, but then apparently they fly it through a gate in Krakoa, because we actually see them leave from a giant flower on the moon. So that's kind of interesting. The fact that they've erected some kind of force bubble, and I don't know. I mean, we don't even know if the Krakoan plants need air. I mean, they are still plants, so I would assume it still needs air and sunlight. So, and we do see a dome over it. So that's kind of cool when you start thinking about Krakoa being able to, you know, grow these plants as long as there's air and light. It really allows the X-Men to become cosmic in a way. So anyway, they say, just scientists, huh? How exactly do you think humans went from sticks to bombs? So that's a good point as well. And we don't know who says that, but it sounds like something Wolverine would say, right? Like, yeah, you say they're not soldiers and we shouldn't be out there, you know, trying to kill them. We should be trying to keep them safe. They're not, you know, members of the war, but like to Wolverine's point, how do you think they went from sticks to bombs? Like they're part of it. You know, they're choosing to be out there that far. On the next page, we get some text and it basically tells us about the different sort of machines, Sentinel type machines, Sentinel to Nimrod progression. We get the original Sentinels Alpha, which would be the Mark 1 through the Mark 8. So these are non-sentient, mutant-hating robots. They're based on non-replicating adaptive technology. So they can't clone themselves. They're not, they don't replicate themselves, but they do have adaptive technology where, you know, if a certain mutant is attacking them in a certain way with a certain amount of powers, they do have the ability to try to adapt and overcome. But they're not, they can't think for themselves. Right, they're just pre-programmed. The next step up would be a master mold. So this is a replicating machine. This is one that can make copies of itself. It's also adaptive, and it's basically a sentinel factory. It's self-aware, and it's capable of creating sentinel drones. And then when you step up above that, you're talking about the mother mold. So this is what they're on their way to destroy. So now we're talking about a replicating adaptive sentinel factory that is self-aware, and it's capable of creating other master molds. So the master mold itself, it can only create the low level non-sentient sentinels, basically just creating the mutant hating robots. The mother mold can create master molds, which then in turn can create the low level sentinels. So when you're talking about bringing a mother mold online, it's going to create these master molds. And not only is it going to create master molds, it's going to create more advanced master molds as the mother mold learns more, right? So that's what you're talking about, where eventually you get to a Nimrod, because the mother mold keeps learning and keeps creating more advanced and more advanced master molds. So given enough time, a mother mold is supposedly capable of producing purely adaptable machines based on nano-sentinel technology. And we start talking about a step up in terms of individual sentinels. It would be an Omega Sentinel. So that's a human that's been infected with that nano sentinel technology that the mother mold may eventually learn enough and gain enough ability and resources to create. So nano sentinel technology is basically the way you infect a human with these microscopic robots that then transform the human from being a human into a machine that becomes an Omega Sentinel. And then at the top of the food chain is the Nimrod. It's a pure nano sentinel construct, anti-mutant, adaptive, self-aware, self-replicating, and virtually indestructible. So that's what we've seen kind of calling the shots, pulling the strings for the machines in the X-Men Year 100 storyline, where we've seen the remaining mutants on Earth finally get the information that the X-Men are acting on here to go and stop Nimrod's very earliest seeds from being planted and coming to pass. On the next page, we get sort of a timeline of that. So Nimrod is the end state. It's the nano sentinel construct. And Moira in her 10th life has learned that while emergent AIs are unavoidable, like there's no way to stop artificial intelligence from happening, because we did see in one of her timelines, she went and assassinated all the different members of the Trask family trying to avoid that. Reaches a certain threshold where it's unavoidable. Like you reach a certain level of technology, a certain level of human consciousness, and certain level of machines that AI is just going to happen. It might not be the Trask, maybe it's somebody else, but you can't stop the AIs from becoming a thing. But you can stop the anti-mutant Nimrod. That his existence is not unavoidable. And it happens as a product of particular intent, which is, hey, we want to destroy mutants, and it's manufactured for the purpose of destroying mutants. So Moira 10 and Apocalypse theorize that Nimrod is basically the main threat to the long-term survival of mutants. And so that's what we saw in the last couple issues of Powers of 10, where Moira and Apocalypse were able to acquire the information surrounding Nimrod's origin. And those Nimrod origin files implied the raw development and processing power necessary to produce a Nimrod is entirely dependent on certain technologically thresholds being reached. So Nimrod almost always occurs in conjunction with or as a result of a mother mold. So that's why they're on their way to stop this mother mold from coming online. And when they got that information, they got that Nimrod origin file. We know that Wolverine killed Moira, Moira reincarnated, and now in her 11th lifetime here, Moira and Charles have tasked several mutants with creating a system, and they call that system Sleeping Giant, that monitors for Nimrod technological thresholds being reached and or the attempted creation of a mother mold. So when the Orcus protocols were enacted, that Sleeping Giant program that Moira and Professor X had had created, it discovers that Orcus exists by that the information provided by that Sleeping Giant program. Hey, you're just looking for maybe what certain scientific breakthroughs happen, what scientific research papers are being written, what certain clandestine organizations are up to, scientists moving around and congregating in certain places, scientists that are known to have worked on mother mold technology in the past. So once all that happens, Charles Xavier and Magneto were able to acquire the Orcus, the plans for the Orcus Forge, which is the orbiting platform that goes around the sun. And that's what we saw when we saw Mystique and Sabretooth and that team go into the Damage Control Incorporated data center and steal the information there. That was the plans for this Orcus Forge. And so they, even though it was dormant at the time, they know that it could come online soon. So that's that kind of the impetus of getting Cyclops' team together to head to this this platform and destroy it. So Professor X and Magneto say, all right, X-Men, you got to go destroy the mother mold because ultimately that will prevent the creation of Nimrod. On the next page, our third text page in a row, which usually I can see why people, usually Hickman doesn't do this, and I can see why, because people's eyes are going to start glazing over. But it's a pretty short one. It's Project Achilles. It's part of the Department of State of the United States, and it's basically the superhuman, super maximum security prison that exists. And I haven't heard of this before. I always heard of like the Ark and some other,
like the Raft.
Yeah, the Raft, but never this Project Achilles. But leave it to Hickman. I mean, maybe somebody else came up with it before. I don't know, but leave it to Hickman to go even above and beyond any of the other stuff they've done. And this is really what I think they would do when you start talking about how dangerous these people are. So it's built to house only a maximum of 30 superpowered criminals, the quote unquote worst of the worst. And it has all the necessary components on site to comply with all the legal and extra constitutional requirements, along with a security staff and a judicial staff that rotates on and off the site every 3 months. So basically what that means is it's kind of its own little world, and you bring people there. And since nobody comes or goes on a like daily basis or a weekly basis or whatever, you're able to control the environment a lot more and prevent escape, right? You can just basically lock it down for 3 months, for 90 days, and anybody you see coming or going during that time, is an enemy. It's something that shouldn't be going down. So once somebody arrives at Achilles, they stay at Achilles until their shift is over, that shift lasting 3 months. And the only exceptions are for an external breach or a loss of containment. So the only time that you would not actively attack or try to stop people from coming or going would be if you know that there's a breach happening or there's an escape happening. Civilian access and special admittance to Achilles are only possible with dispensation from the United States Department of State. And there's a little note here that says a pre-approved list of civilians, almost all immediate family to the people that are there, is allowed access to the inmates once a year. So you get to visit with your family once a year. But to date, no one has ever requested such a visit, which I think is great as well, because, if you're part of your family is one of the worst 30 supervillains in the world, why would you want to go visit them? You're probably trying to forget that they exist. So we actually get a look at the Project Achilles Superhuman Supermax, and one of the worst is about to be arraigned. And then, you know, they have their own courtroom, their own judge, their own lawyers. And it's clear that the defense attorney isn't real comfortable being that he is assigned to this case. And even though he's making his arguments to dismiss, he's stuttering all along. He's sweating. He's clearly scared. And the reason he's scared is because his client is Sabretooth. And so the judge says, yeah, we're not throwing anything out. Your client's being charged under the new 12 strike rule. How many times has this guy been in trouble? And it, you know, all that supersedes any intent. So motion is denied. Anything else? No. Okay. How does your client plead? And we see that it's Sabretooth, and he admits it. I'm guilty. I got bad manners. You know, he's done everything that he's been charged with. And he's just having a good time because he knows what's about to happen. He says, it doesn't matter what you do to me. There has never been a place built that can hold me. And if I'm really being honest, I'm not really going to sit here and let you judge me anyway. Like, the world has changed. And we've seen that in House of X, like right from the beginning. He's like, you think you can chain me? You think you can stop me? And really, we all know that you can't. And, you know, as we see him standing there, he is indeed chained and cuffed up. And we've got a bunch of guards that are literally holding their guns on him. But none of that's going to stop him from escaping if he really wants to. But he doesn't need to, because at that point, White Queen shows up along with a couple of the cuckoos, and she basically tells the judge that mutants are no longer to be judged by human courts. They're not humans. They don't play by human rules. They're not subject to human laws. So she says, yeah, basically you're going to surrender him to me. Because we all know that Krakoa is about to become a sovereign nation, and all Krakoans, no matter where they are, natural born or otherwise, now enjoy the privilege of diplomatic immunity. And that's a recent gift from your State Department. So I feel bad for the judge, and I sort of see the other side of it, the human side of it. Well, you're saying that any mutant has the ability to do anything they want and not be judged by human law. I get that that is super dangerous and super scary for humans, and not really right when it comes to mutants like Sabretooth. You don't want him out there just slaughtering, you know, any humans that he wants for any reason he wants, and to have no consequences. But at the same time, if you look at it from the other side, these mutants have been hunted almost to extinction. They're not humans, and why should they be subject to human law? If you're subjugating yourself to human law, then you're agreeing to anything that the humans decide should be affecting mutants, right? So if human and governments decide, hey, there shouldn't be any more mutants, everybody's going to take this this vaccine that prevents the X gene from manifesting. You basically have when you say everybody has to take this when they're a baby, regardless of whether we test for the X gene or not, like everybody just has to take this. You've essentially exterminated mutants. And why do humans have the right to say that? So I totally get it. And it all comes, you know, philosophically, it all comes with this sort of caveat. If you do agree to this, if you're the mutants and you say, okay, all mutants are, they all have diplomatic immunity. Human laws do not apply to them. That can work if the mutants police their own, right? And you've got to prove that you'll be willing to do it and that you'll keep humanity safe. Otherwise, I don't think humanity sticks with what they say. Yeah, we're going to give the Krakoan nation sovereignty, and we're going to give them jurisdiction over all their citizens. But if you can't keep those citizens under control, then why should we give that to you? If you have mutants out there slaughtering humans, then it's just war at that point. And it doesn't matter what the laws have. So anyway, a couple of cuckoos say, hey, we have all the paperwork you need. Totally cool if you leave the chains on. And the prosecuting attorney is like, this is not going to happen. The White Queen is, it is going to happen. And what it means is simply that we don't answer to you anymore. So again, it's exactly as it should be in my mind, because if the mutants... and they have been for so long, have been willing to accept human law and subjugate themselves, that's what's led them to kind of the edge of extinction. And so one of the guards is like, this thing's a killer. I don't know how you can let it go. And Sabretooth is gloating about it. You know, I'm just like my mama made me. I'm not close to done killing. And even White Queen, she's like, he's a monster. I can't disagree, but he's our monster. And from this day forward, mutants are not going to be judged by human courts or by the likes of you. And so the prosecuting attorney actually pulls out her gun. She's like, this is not how today's going to end. Not on my watch. And White Queen doesn't even blink, like doesn't, you know, she's not scared. She says, look, this is all about the art of diplomacy. It's all about equalizing power dynamics. So you got to realize that there's a larger purpose being served here today. And let's just pretend like you could have stopped me, but you're going to do what you're supposed to do for the greater good. And as they walk out with Sabretooth, White Queen turns around and says, it's a brave new world, darlings. Best get used to it. So kind of tough for the humans to swallow. But again, I think it's the natural progression of wanting to have your own mutant state, right? I mean, if you want the mutants to all follow you and to all come together as one nation, you've got to offer them something, and offering them protection and offering them, hey, come and be a citizen of Krakoa. And that means that you are now you're being governed. I don't want to say under the rule of Professor X or any particular mutant, but you become part of that society and you follow the rules of mutant society instead of the rules of human society. You follow the laws of mutant society instead of the laws of human society. And it's that separation. That's really what you're talking about here, is you're talking about separating out mutants from, you know, the regular world. And that means you've got to come and live on Krakoa and you've got to agree to abide by the Krakoan laws. But as mutants, you've also have to enforce those laws. Like I said, you can't just let mutants out to wreak havoc and cause destruction and kill people, because you're going to ruin the incentive. Like, no other nations on Earth are going to be willing to let you be your own society and be your own nation if that nation is out of control and it's anarchy. Because ultimately that causes destruction everywhere. So yeah, you want to go and kind of be off on your own and police your own, great. We'll allow you to do that, because in the long run, it's better for everybody, but you better be able to keep your people under control. So I don't know, John Paul, what do you think?
It was a couple of times I'm just like struggling not to talk about stuff that's already happened, because there's many complexities that come about because of this. And as you would imagine, just by the reaction of the guard and the judge, this kind of action, even though legal, breeds animosity. And it's difficult to take.
Yeah, 100%. And there's parallels in real life where you're basically saying to these people, hey, you're above the law. And that's how these humans see it. Wait, how come these individuals are above the law? Because when you think about it, the only way this truly would be fair is if you said, okay, mutants are not subject to human law. Okay, then mutants never come into any areas where human law is in effect. You go to Krakoa and you never leave Krakoa, and you people, mutants that live on Krakoa, you follow whatever Krakoan laws are, and that's fine and that works for you because you're not affecting us. But when you start talking about, okay, if those Krakoans are coming over into areas that aren't Krakoa, areas that are governed by human law, but they're not subject to the law that covers that, that's an advantage, that's an inequality. And we see it mirrored in our own, real world. We've seen hundreds of examples over the years of people with diplomatic immunity doing things that are harmful to other people and, not having the ability to prosecute them or make them pay for their mistakes is kind of, it's injustice in a way. And we've seen people fight against it. So yeah, I could totally see how you might have an underground group that says, this is not okay. We got to find a way to stop this, and all that can definitely be a product of this sort of political maneuvering. So great that Hickman is bringing the political side of it in as well. We get another text page next. It's talking about the Omega Cycle, and this is basically how an Omega Sentinel comes to be, how a human turns into an Omega Sentinel. So stage one is the infection. A human host is injected with the nano Sentinel technology. Number two is nesting. It's self-replicating biological machine that propagates in the host. So, you know, you get a few of the nano Sentinel nanites injected in you and they start reproducing themselves. So number three is replication. The biological machines start replacing the existing host systems and organs. So once there's enough of these biological machines, these nanites, they basically start replicating and replacing your, you know, the tissues and the cells of your lungs and your heart and your, you know, your liver and basically all the insides. Everything is being transformed from being organic to being machine. Next up is activation. So this is a post-dormancy transformation. Once enough of the host becomes operative in terms of having been replaced, it's capable of activating in proximity to a mutant. So once, and it doesn't say how much it takes to activate. Does it have to be, you know, a majority of the person's body or whatever that's been replaced by machines? But eventually enough happens. Enough has been replaced of the biological tissue has been replaced with machine tissue, then you're activated in the proximity when you get close to a mutant. Next up is union. So this is after activation. The human host becomes aware of the combined consciousness of it and the sentinel directives it's been infected with. And this is almost always a prolonged process that mirrors those recovering from trauma. So you can understand why that would be the case, because basically once enough of you has been replaced and enough that you become aware that, hey, I've got this infection, you're going to have a hard time as a human realizing that, hey, I'm losing my my individuality. I'm losing my consciousness. It's all being overwritten by the consciousness of these machines. So next up, you reach the level of adaption, which this means the total integration of host and machine. So basically they're, you know, whoever you were before is gone. You've been all replaced as machine. And then you reach the Omega level at level 8, which is total machine state. So the host has been completely integrated into the machine, and now you're just a machine. You're just an Omega Sentinel. So next page, we see the Orcus Forge out there orbiting over the sun, basically just this giant Sentinel head, basically a master mold head with the satellite around it. And a couple of the people on the station are talking. The Omega Sentinel that's there is talking to the director, Dr. Greger, saying, you know, she's asking her, you think this is a mistake? And the Sentinel saying, well, self-preservation is completely rational, but it's the panic it produces where people make mistakes. And so Dr. Greger's asking the Sentinel, you know, think we're panicking? Because again, this Omega Sentinel, it doesn't have any emotions. It doesn't have any feeling. It's everything is objective in their mind. So Greger wants to know, hey, you know, from an objective point of view, you think bringing this mother mold online is a mistake. So the Omega says, well, I think you built this mother mold to create master molds. And the second you lose control of it, it's not hard to see how this whole entire planetary system becomes covered in gray emotionalists instead of pink fleshy bits. Right. That's the end goal. So after all, they know where mutants come from. So what she's saying is you do this before you're ready as a species and you lose control of this. Like, cause once the mother mold comes online, then you're kind of done, right? Like it's online, it's sentient. You won't be able to shut it off. And eventually it might be that you realize you've made a mistake because it grows beyond your control. And instead of your system having humans in it and having people that have emotions and basically are people, in the Omega Sentinel's words, the pink fleshy bits, you have nothing but cold, emotionless gray bits because your whole system is now inhabited by machines, right? Because she says right there, they know where mutants come from. So yeah, mutants come from human babies that have the X gene and mutate. So you want to be 100% sure that you never have any more mutants, don't have any more humans. And then we don't have to worry about humans reproducing, and we don't have to worry about them mutating into mutants. So that's the danger. So Dr. Greger even concedes that, like saying, hey, that's a fair point. And it's why this satellite, this Forge, was built with these control collars. So if things go south, we can basically, you know, remove the four docking clamps that keep the head of the mother mold in place, and it will fall into the sun. So another reason to be so close to the sun. So Omega's asking, well, how long before she wakes? And she says, well, we could wake her up now, but even at the exponential rate she's learning, she still has a while to go before we're comfortable. She needs to get past the Heller-Faust line. And I should have looked that up. I didn't, but I my understanding, if I remember correctly, is that's a line where you have to reach a certain level of intelligence where you can kind of understand that you don't just get to do whatever you want to do, in terms of, hey, machines don't have emotions. They don't have compassion. They don't have empathy. So they've got to reach a level of intelligence that just doesn't have them out there killing humans just because they can. And then Mega says, yeah, that's good. Who needs an AI that has the potential to be a sociopath? So at that moment, they hear that there's a problem. And apparently they've detected the mutants that are flying there. They've detected Cyclops and his team. They say, we've got incoming. They've come from the dark side of Phoenix. They're using the planet to slingshot toward us. And Dr. Greger's like, wait, friendly? No, absolutely not. It's a modified Shi'ar's class scout. So there's only one possibility of who it is. It's the X-Men. So they're like, well, how did they already know? How could they know what we're doing? And they figure, well, somebody must have talked, or somebody was listening, or maybe somebody was watching the whole time. Doesn't really matter. What's obvious is that they're coming and they're after the mother mold. So Dr. Greger wants to know, well, is there a way to stop it from getting there? And they say, well, no, not that ship. Its long range countermeasures are too good. And, you know, we could unload everything we have at it at this distance. They're not even going to, you know, not even gonna be able to get through their shields. So the X-Men have actually done a good job of having this be somewhat of a surprise attack. So they're not sure that they're going to be able to get the mother mold fully online before they X-Men get there. So they're like, we're going to have to wait for them to actually board us and then try to repel them. So Dr. Greger's like, okay, we're on our way back to the control room, and say, no, stay there. Stay where you are toward, you know, the center of the space station, and protect the mother mold from, you know, anything that could happen. And Omega's like, why don't we just call all the drones back from Mercury to defend the station? It's like, well, we already have, but again, the X-Men planned this very well. The Sentinel drones that Orcus has currently, they're at their furthest point away in orbit on Mercury from where the mother mold is currently. So they're on their way back, but they're not going to get there in time. The X-Men are going to get there long before. So Greger's pretty dejected, and her husband says, cheer up. It's just a little fight for the survival of our species, nothing to worry about. Which again, it shows the zealotry of these Orcus scientists, thinking that if mutants exist, it automatically means that humans won't, that humans will stop existing. So it's kind of, yeah, I don't get that line of thinking. Just because somebody else exists doesn't mean that it's your species is going to stop existing. So they go ahead and they fire at the ship, the Shi'ar ship of the X-Men, but again, they're not even getting through the shields. And Cyclops tells everybody, okay, we're almost there, send them in. So they have the plans to the mother mold, which allows Kurt, Nightcrawler, to teleport in. We know he can't teleport places he hasn't seen or doesn't know, because then he runs a risk of teleporting into a wall or a bulkhead or whatever. But because they have the schematics, they have the map, they're going to know where he's safe to actually teleport to. And so they remind him that the schematics say there's basically four ejection collars. And they need to know if the plans are correct, because the plan would be for Kurt to teleport in, bringing along one other mutant with him to each of the four spots. They can pull the levers and release the master, the mother mold head into the sun. So they'll fight if they need to, but it'd be a lot easier if they can just teleport to each location. So Kurt goes on his way, starts teleporting in, checks all four of the spots. When he gets to spot three, he sees Dr. Gregor there and the Omega Sentinel. And Kurt's kind of says, wow, what a surprise. Picking sides, are we? And the Omega Sentinel says, actually, that was all of you, wasn't it? So he then teleports away, and the Omega Sentinel realizes that they're going to go for the control collars. So Dr. Gregor calls her husband saying, we've been breached. They have a teleporter. And her husband, Erasmus, says, yeah, read his file. He has point-to-point teleportation powers, but they're real low yield. So they're still going to have to dock and kind of insert some kind of assault force. So I moved our forces to the hangars so that when they land, we can attack them. And hopefully that'll buy us enough time to hold them off until the Sentinel drones get there. And the Omega Sentinel goes, well, that's disappointing. She's like, and Dr. Gregor's like, well, what do you mean? She goes, it's a very linear plan for a very non-linear foe. So she's already like, that's not going to work. Like, you think they're just going to come land in the hangar, try to fight their way to each of these dock collars and pull the levers? No, they're the X-Men. They think outside the box. And sure enough, instead of landing on the hangar, they just land on a different spot of the ship and breach their way in through, basically through the bulkhead. So Nightcrawler's teleported back to the ship. He says, hey, they have an Omega Sentinel in there. And Wolverine's like, well, we'll deal with it when we have to. First things first, you know, we've got to get inside and start getting to these collars. So they extend the breaching collar. They start to cut their way into the space station. And it just so happens that Erasmus is in that area, which it's a pretty big space station. So I'm going to forgive Hickman this one that, oh, they just so happened to pick the one spot where Erasmus was to breach. So Erasmus drops some doors down to seal off that section of the space station, calls his wife. Dr. Gregor says, bad news. They're cutting through the hull of the station, making an entrance that way, which is just another failure in today's string of failures. So he tells her, you know, they're a lot smarter than we maybe had given them credit for, and they're hitting exactly the right section to access the whole station. And they must have the plans for the station somehow. So our only hope is to respond in a way that's not linear, you know, to the point that the Omega Sentinel was making earlier. He says, irrationally even. And Gregor's like, wait, what are you talking about? What are you doing? And what he's doing is actually puts a bomb together. And he says, I'm willing to do whatever it takes to build a better world. So again, we go back to the idea of these people are so scared of mutants. They're so sure that mutants, just by existing and by continuing to exist, mean the extinction of the human race. Not the evolution, not that Homo sapiens are going to cease to exist because eventually they all evolve to the next level, but that it means the extermination of Homo sapiens and all you are left with is Homo superior, which I just don't get, right? Like, maybe it's inherent in the level of intelligence that Homo sapiens have that you fight to not evolve. It just doesn't make any sense to me. I guess like Homo erectus and any of the predecessors that are different enough from humans to be considered a different species and thus have a different name, like Homo erectus or, you know, Cro-Magnon or any of the rest of those, they didn't have the intelligence or the self-awareness to realize that they were becoming extinct and another species of human was evolving and taking over. So they never bothered to fight against it. I mean, I guess that's what you just have to assume, but I mean, I would think you'd want to evolve. Like, don't we want our children to be better than we are? Don't we want them to be smarter and have more resources and more abilities to survive, especially with the way we're decimating our planet and the rate we're decimating it? They're going to need all the powers and abilities they possibly can get. Like, I think we want to survive, but these people know they're, it's very much a metaphor for, you know, conservatism and right-wing extremism, where you say, I'm so scared of change, I'm going to stick my head in the sand and ignore any amount of change, any amount of evolution, any amount of learning, any amount of intelligence, any amount of bettering myself, because I just like the way things are now. and I'm going to stick my head in the sand and I'm going to, you know, cross my arms and be stubborn and hold on with every fiber of my being. So in order to prove his point and stop this change from happening, Erasmus is willing to sacrifice himself. He creates this bomb and detonates it right below the section of the ship or the space station where the X-Men have docked, and he blows it up, and we see the Shi'ar scout ship is damaged and it's thrown off of the space station, and they weren't able to get inside. So ends on a bit of a cliffhanger that way. Next page just has a quote from Magneto saying, "For you to die, you would have to be forgotten, and no one forgets a founder of a nation." So again, that quote that Magneto was telling Cyclops at the beginning of the issue, when we knew Cyclops was scared and had his doubts and was worried about not surviving the mission, and Magneto saying, you know, no matter what, one way or the other, you do this, you help us found this nation, you'll never be forgotten. On the next page, we have more text about the Krakoan alphabet. So the whole alphabet is there. We've seen these symbols throughout the entire House of X, Powers of 10 issues. And now that you know what the symbols mean in terms of what letter, you can go and decode all this stuff. I would be curious if there's anybody who is a big enough X-Men fan who has gotten to the point where they've memorized this, where they can just look at it and read it without having to go and translate like letter by letter. You know what I mean? Like, even if you, it's one thing to look at a symbol and then, okay, this is an A, this is an S, this is a T or whatever, right? And you write it out and then you can read it. Like, is there somebody out there that can just look at these symbols and just read it? Somebody who's sure really good with language. Yeah, there probably is. I'm terrible with language. I only speak one language. I can only read one language. But yeah, I mean, you think about it, just like there are people that learn like Chinese or, you know, Egyptian hieroglyphics or, you know, Japanese, and the, you know, those, their symbols are completely different. Their alphabet is completely different. I'm not one of those people, man. I cannot even come close. It would be me literally going letter by letter and having to transpose before I'd be able to read it. But yeah, if you're interested enough, you can go and check it all out. What we're told about it is that this Krakoan language, it's not the true language of Krakoa. So upon arriving for the first time to the mutant state of Krakoa, the resident a resident telepath imprints this language into the mind of the mutant. So once you're done, you're capable of reading it and speaking it and understanding this language, but this is not a true indigenous language. And so this language was created by Doug Ramsey, and it was created to be the first indigenous language of mutants. I think it's called Atakanis is the phrase. So it means indigenous. It means, you know, kind of inherent to being a mutant, sort of has, you know, evolved from mutant society. We know mutants haven't, you know, grown up in one place to where they've developed their own language. So Krakoa is an island that does have its own language, right? And there's a difference between the two. So this one is a manufactured language. The native language of Krakoa, the living mutant island, is untranslatable. It's human or mutant brains can't comprehend it. They can't understand it by trying to read it or by hearing it. It just, the way that it's constructed, you're just not able to understand it unless you're the mutant known as Cypher, Doug Ramsey, who's a polyglot whose mutant powers basically understand any language. So they needed a language that they could share, because going back to that statement from Magneto in the first issue, like, a society needs its own language. Doug Ramsey created this to be the Atakonis language of, or the indigenous language of mutants. And so everybody, first time they get to Krakoa, they're implanted with it, they know it, they share it. So it's the closest they can get to an indigenous language without actually having developed their own over millennia of evolution. But important to note that it's not the same as the native language of the Krakoan mutant island. So that's it. That's the last of the issue. And there are some more text pages, but all the languages in Krakoan. So again, now that you have the alphabet, you can go and translate the stuff if you want to. So while I'm a proponent of definitely reading the text pages, I won't go so far as to say you need to go and translate all the stuff that is in Krakoan. So did you ever go and once you had the alphabet and look at what any of that stuff said, John Paul?
You know, initially I started doing that and then I just got lazy. I was like,
it's not going to be like this huge plot point where he's going to put something in there. They're probably just more along the lines of the quotes that he's putting in is my thought. Where
it's like an Easter egg hunt kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I would argue that yes, and we've talked about it before, you can get the majority of the story by not reading the text pages, but I think the text pages, they help explain motivation and explain the events and have a better understanding of the groups, the politics of the story that he's telling. So I do feel there's worth there, but again, we've also said you don't have to. And so I think that's another step down when you start talking about the Easter eggs of the Krakoan alphabet, or the Krakoan messages. But action packed issue for sure, probably the most fast paced and action packed issue of the two series so far. I mean, the last issue of Powers of 10 was pretty fast paced, I think this goes even faster, with the exception of the scene in the courtroom with Sabretooth. This is kind of almost all action. It's all one big fight, and the next issue is kind of the same. So, a lot of action, a lot of great art by Pepe Larraz. And the big thing that comes through for me, the big two things in this issue are the whole idea of mutants no longer being subjected to human law, even to the point of mutants realizing that they've got to take it to an extreme and even protect people that they don't want to protect, like Sabretooth, because White Queen even admits that he's a monster. And the other big takeaway I get is just how dedicated these Orcus members are, just as a group, how dedicated they are. We saw Erasmus willing to blow himself up to get Mother Mold online. So I guess fear, as many American politicians have discovered and used playing on people's fears to get elected time and time again, fear is an extremely powerful motivator. People will make a lot of silly choices and will go out of their way to sort of refuse to listen to reason or follow any kind of logical thinking, all based out of fear, all based out of the what if. Well, yeah, it's not likely, but I'm scared enough that it could happen that I'm willing to blow myself up to possibly prevent it from happening. So for me, those are the big two takeaways, but really great issue, really fast paced. I know this is one of your favorite issues, John Paul. What do you have to say about it?
Oh yeah. I like this issue so much that I bought the single issue twice. three times, because I bought a variant and then two of the regular. So yeah. And then the next one is just as good, if not maybe slightly better. But these are definitely a highlight of the series. Not to say they're the best, objectively, but this is where stuff starts to ramp up.
Yeah, I agree. I think, the next one might be slightly better only because of emotional impact.
Right.
But it's just as fast-paced and just as action-packed as this one. So all that to say, be sure you join us next time when we talk about the next issue, because it's absolutely spectacular. So I think that's going to do it for this episode. As always, we want to thank everybody for joining us. Be sure you go and check out our Kickstarter Spotlight from last week, where I spoke to Liam Sharp about the Unseen Jack Katz. That campaign is still going on, and had a great chat with Liam about the contemporary of Golden Age artists like Alex Toth and Alex Raymond. Jack Katz is still with us, and we have the chance to celebrate his life's work and this hardcover that's coming out. That's basically the reward for the campaign is just years and years of unpublished work, artwork, and stories from Jack, and they're absolutely amazing. So please go and check it out, even if you don't have the means to join the campaign, or it's just not your thing, at least share it on social media. Jack's 93 years old. He lives on a fixed income. So, you know, the more financial security we can get him through donations and through pledges of this campaign just allows him to, you know, have one less thing that he needs to worry about, allows him to keep creating even at 93 years old. The guy just wants to paint and draw. And that's amazing. So many of these golden age artists, we don't get a chance to celebrate until they're no longer with us. And the fact that we can do this now and Jack is still here, I think is so incredible. So be sure and go and check it out. Pledge if you can, or if you'd like to. If not, at least share it on social media. Really appreciate everybody's help with that. So anything else to add, John Paul?
No, I think that's, yeah, that's it.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.